This is Betty Trunell speaking for the Decatur Public Library. Recently, our guest, Judge A.G. Weber III, told us that his family had been closely associated with the Mueller Company of Decatur. Today, we are asking Judge Weber to tell us the story of the Mueller Company and the part it's played in the history of Decatur. Judge Weber?
I'm afraid I'm beginning to sound like the oldest inhabitant around here, which, believe me, I'm not, but it is true that there are some connections that go back a great many years. I think on the prior tape I mentioned that my grandfather had worked as an apprentice to Hieronymus Mueller, who was the founder of the company. Hieronymus Mueller came here from Germany, sometime in the late 1840s. There was a revolution going on in Europe generally at that time, and he and a number of other young men elected to emigrate rather than subject themselves to the military power of the German state. And I believe the history is he first came to Rockford, the Rockford area, and in the middle 1850s came to Decatur and opened up a gun shop. He was a machinist, an exceedingly skilled mechanic. The shop was located on what is now the northeast corner of the Milliken Bank. It would be the 200 block of East Main Street on the south side. And that was the beginning of the company. My grandfather, as I indicated, came here about five or six years later. He was a younger man than Mr. Mueller, but in looking around for various jobs, he became an apprentice to Mueller in, I believe, about 1869. In addition to his gun shop, Mueller was also a skilled plumber. And at that time, gas lights were the new way of illumination, and many of the old buildings on North Water Street, a lot of them are being torn down now for parking lots. I suppose it's only a matter of time until the entire country will become one large paved parking lot, but at any rate, my grandfather, as an apprentice, and Mr. Mueller put in the gas piping in many of those buildings, and I think some of it may still be there. So that started the relationship between the families. As I indicated on the last tape, my grandfather went off to railroading and eventually became a lawyer, and when he came back here, Mr. Mueller employed him then as his lawyer. It was, I believe, for the first few years on a kind of a case-by-case or hit-and-miss basis, because nobody was that prosperous, but by about 1900, the company had grown to such an extent that they felt they needed full-time legal counsel, and my grandfather was employed then about 1900 as general counsel for the company and for the family, and he so remained until his retirement to about 1936. My father took over then as counsel, and in 1947, when Everett Mueller died, my father was elected president of the Mueller Company and remained as president until his retirement in 1964. Meanwhile, I had come on the scene and the company retained me as their counsel until I left to go on the bench in 1966. So from 1869 to 1966, there was almost 100 years of relationship there. I'm always amazed at the number of people in Decatur who somehow believe that the Weber families and the Mueller families are related. I think it perhaps grows out of this long business relationship, but there is none. No Weber is married to a Mueller, at least since 1869. Since we all came from South Germany, I'm not prepared to say that there weren't some ancestors that might have been related back there, but certainly nothing in modern times. As to the history of the company itself, shortly before he died, about a year and a half ago, Mr. Frank Mueller put together a privately published book called The Mueller Story. I would hope that the library has a copy of this. As I indicated, it was written mostly by Jack Banton, well, entirely by Jack Banton as far as the final draft goes, who was for many years with the Decatur newspapers as in various capacities, city editor and the like. Jack and Frank sat down and put this all together. A number of us were called in by Frank to help out. I did and some others. But the book tells in rather prolix detail the history of the company and the family, so I don't feel that I need take up a lot of space on the tape doing that, but perhaps a personal recollection or two of some of the members of the family whom I knew might fill in a gap. I think probably the one that of the older generation that I knew the best was Mr. Adolph Mueller. As a footnote here, I might add that most all of the Muellers were known either as Mr. Adolph or Mr. Robert or Mr. Everett for the very simple reason that the company has always been owned and managed by people named Mueller. And if you go into the central office and ask for Mr. Mueller, they'd say, which one of the 22 do you want to talk to? So within the organization itself, it seemed a little disrespectful to call them by their Christian names. On the other hand, Mr. Mueller was not meaningful. So the custom developed of referring to them by their Christian names, but with a Mr. prefix to it. So it was Mr. Adolph or Mr. Robert or Mr. Everett or whoever. As I indicated, the one I perhaps knew the best and the most prominent one in the whole history of the company was Mr. Adolph Mueller. It's a little surprising. He was of the six sons that Hieronymus Mueller had. He had six sons and one daughter. Mr. Adolph was the fifth son, yet he became the dominant force in that company and in the family for almost 40 years. Ordinarily, the firstborn son is the one who, by right of primogeniture or whatever, becomes the dominating force in the family. And to a large extent, the Mueller family and Mueller company are the same thing. But here, the fifth son was the one who appeared and remained as the dominant one in the family and hence in the company. It wasn't by default. The others were also strong personalities. But Mr. Adolf was the strongest of the group. Mr. Hieronymus Mueller was not exactly killed, but he died as a result of extensive burns in 1900, and the firstborn son, Henry, took over the company as president, but he died rather prematurely in 1910, I believe, and it was at that point that Mr. Adolf took over and ran the company as president and as chairman until his death in 1944. I believe, as a matter of fact, he had been the force even during the last years of Henry Mueller's lifetime. But he was quite a character. He had a dominant personality. You knew as soon as he walked in the room that you were in the presence of somebody rather special. And I got to know him rather well because there was what they called the hiking club. It was sort of an informal group of men of about the same age. Mr. Adolf was in it, my grandfather, Mr. Harry Haynes, who was one of the founders of the Haynes and Essex store downtown. Mr. Robert I. Hunt was part of the group, and there were several others. Every Sunday afternoon, without exception, and sometimes other days during the week when they could get together, they'd meet and hike, sometimes as much as 10-15 miles out into the country and back. And when I got to the point that I was able to navigate fairly well, my grandfather would take me along on those hikes. I'll confess now that there's nobody here to rap me on the knuckles for saying so, that it wasn't exactly a thrilling experience for a boy of 10 or 12 to go hiking with a group of men who were up in their 70s. But I was told to go, and being dutiful, I went. I look back on it now, it was a good experience because now, many years later, I remember all of them and remember a good deal of what they would talk about. Mr. Adolf was, Mrs. Mueller used to go into a towering rage. Of course, they were quite wealthy and could afford anything they wanted, but for the Sunday hikes in the summertime, Mr. Adolf would go to some farm supply store and buy a large farmer's straw hat, the kind that a farmer would wear on his tractor out in the country, clap it on his head, and start off for our house over on Ewing Avenue. Mrs. Mueller thought that was absolutely terrible that anyone in his station in life would wear a 59-cent straw hat to go hiking, but Apparently she didn't get anywhere with the argument because he wore it all the time. He did each year get a new one. He didn't save the old one. In wintertime, of course, they wore warmer clothing. But we would go, generally down to the area south of Lake Decatur, which is now generally known as South Shores. That, at the time, was wild country. There was nothing there except a few farmhouses. But starting early in the century, the Mueller Company and the families had bought up approximately 1,500 acres of land in that general area, extending from about Route 48 on eastward to about Sand Creek. The idea had been for a number of years that they would build a new plant out there, and that they would then build the houses for the employees around the plant. So there would be a whole sort of Mueller Village or Muellerville or something of the kind. The idea was finally abandoned after World War II, and the land was liquidated and sold for the subdivisions that are there now. But in the 20s and the 30s, it was wild, rough country, which just suited Mr. Adolph to a T. He loved to tramp through the woods, hunting for wildflowers or simply looking at the timber, looking at whatever was there. And he'd spend a great deal of time pointing out to me, as the youngest and presumably the most compliant member of the group, the flowers, the trees, the things that he found there that were really, some of them, quite unusual. There was one particularly dense piece of prairie forest that was always called the Lost 40, because it was so tangled and so primitive that it seemed to be no good for anything. As far as I can make out now, I think that so-called Lost 40 was just about west of where the BorgWarner plant is now on Southside Drive. It's all been cleared up. The hikes were of, I thought, great value to me now, because I had the opportunity of listening to the older men talk about business, about economic affairs. Of course, during the Depression, which started in 1929, they indicated considerable concern about their businesses, and I think I learned a lot from being with them. I knew also Mr. Robert, who was, I think, a little in the shadow of his younger brother, but he was the very pleasant type. He was a public relations man. He never hiked. He didn't want to hike. He would much rather be attending a concert or looking to anything that could promote the Mueller business. He lived well down the end of my time too, and his widow, Mrs. Addie Mueller, even longer than that. I was very well acquainted with her. Lovely lady. Real, if you want to use lady in its best and traditional sense, that was Mrs. Robert Mueller. They built their homes over on Milliken Place, number one, which is right down with its eastern face onto Pine Street, was the Robert Mueller home. And the Adolf Mueller home was back at, I think it's number six. It's the most westerly of the group of homes along the north side there. There's always been some argument as to whether Frank Lloyd Wright designed those homes or not. I don't know that anybody could ever determine finally, but certainly both homes are in the Wright tradition. They look like Wright homes, and they were built about 1910 to 1912, at the time when Wright was first functioning and becoming prominent with his new type of prairie architecture. Both homes are elaborate. Mr. Adolf was quite a gardener, too. He had a large backyard behind the house, and he made quite a specialty of tomatoes. He'd seek out special seeds and special plants, and he had what amounted almost to a wholesale business. He never put in less than 50 tomato plants in the spring, so you can imagine how many bushels of tomatoes showed up in the middle of the summer. But he'd trot around town and hand them to his friends and to take them over to the factory and hand them to the employees, and he always managed to get rid of them. No much question about that. But and he did a marvelous job of it too. A little unusual for a business executive, one of the leading executives in Decatur, to be out in his backyard tending a bunch of tomato plants. But this seemed characteristic of the breed at the time. I can't say for certain, but I'm told that Mr. A.E. Staley Sr. required, when Staley office building was built, that just outside his office there be a terrace where he could keep a garden. Mm-hmm. I think he grew flowers principally, and maybe a few tomatoes, who knows. But at any rate, that generation was somewhat devoted to gardening. The Mueller factory itself moved around in the early days, but eventually settled down over on West El Dorado in Monroe, where it is now. But typical of the era, the directors and the family didn't believe in spending a lot of money on fancy offices. They thought that the money was better spent in production facilities. So the office was about as primitive as anything that you can imagine. It was in a loft. It was lighted by a couple of sawtooth skylights that went to the north. The whole force sat out in one great room that was, perhaps 150 feet long and 40, 50 feet wide. Mr. Adolf did have a private office down at the west end, but everybody else was out in sort of a bullpen with the golden oak desks and creaky chairs. Most of those desks were double desks. People sat facing each other. I've often wondered how anybody could get much work done when every time he looked up, he saw his deskmate across the way looking at him. They did have a switchboard for incoming calls, but there were to be no outgoing calls of a personal nature. The switchboard operator was cautioned on this, and if anybody wanted to make an outgoing call, there was a payphone which hung on a wooden post just outside Mr. Adolph's office, where he could watch and see how much time you were spending on personal business, on company time. He was very paternalistic. This was characteristic of executives at that time, but it was a sincere paternalism. He looked after the employees of his company. They were considered to be family. I know in 1932, when the bottom of the Depression was in force and many of the employees were looked as if they were going to lose their homes, they were not able to make the payments, he called them all together at the plant and told them not to worry, that the company had built up a surplus, and even though they might not be able to sell any products, they would manufacture for inventory and use the surplus to pay the employees so that all of them would have a job and they didn't need to worry about losing their homes. However, there was a price to pay. You got your paycheck, generally on Friday. Mr. Adolph would send for all the paychecks the following Monday or Tuesday, and he would go through them one by one. And if your paycheck had been cashed in either a saloon or a short loan agency, you were called in for a little consultation, more of a lecture on the evils of drink and the evils of short loan companies, and cautioned that this was not to happen again. So he did mix into the personal lives of his employees, but it was with the very best of intentions. Such a thing today would probably cause a strike, but in those days it was somewhat taken for granted that the head of the firm ran everything, his company and your life and your job and all. Mr. Staley was much the same way. What's now called Mueller Lodge grew out of the same general attitude. The lodge was built as a place for recreation for the employees of the company. They were encouraged to go out there whenever they wanted to, and picnics or baseball or whatever. And once a year, there was the Mueller Picnic, where the company had all of the employees and their children and their families come out to the lodge. They'd employ some traveling carnival with a bunch of rides, and baseball teams would be organized, and food was catered in, and it was quite a gala day all the way around. The high point of the evening always came when everybody was assembled in an amphitheater that has since been deteriorated and destroyed. Sat in a hollow with a kind of a stage down at the bottom and seats around the outside in the form of an old Greek Odeon. And Mr. Adolph loved to sing. And at the end of the evening, you'd hear a voice coming from the back singing Old Black Joe. And down the aisleway from the top of the hill to the stage would come the president of the company, Mr. Adolph, in blackface, singing Old Black Joe at the top of his lungs. Now, I can't imagine today a similar situation, but he loved to do it, and he didn't apparently have any stage fright. I was set up to sing, which I can't, got the worst tin ear in the world. I couldn't carry a tune in a bucket, but if anybody told me I had to stand up in front of 2,000 people and sing Old Black Joe, I think I'd expire on the spot, but it became a regular, expected part of the program out there for Mr. Adolph to appear. He was never impressed by anybody. In 1929, he went with a Chamber of Commerce delegation to Europe to look into business prospects and the like. They had gone to Rome, and Mussolini had come to power in Italy a few years before. Mr. Adolph, remembering perhaps his father's experiences in Germany many years before, didn't approve of the fascist form of government. They were all herded into some large hall to meet Premier Mussolini, who was circulating in the crowd, apparently kind of politicking around. And as the story goes, he got close to Mr. Adolph and offered to shake his hand, whereupon Mr. Adolph said to him in English, and I'm sure Mr. Mussolini didn't understand it, "How do you do, Mr. Mussolini? I disapprove of everything you do, and I therefore will not shake your hand," and turned away. Indication of the powerful personality of the man, who was perfectly willing and felt no compunction about sassing, if you will, the head of state of the sovereign state of Italy. But this was his personality. His I knew quite well, too, his son, Everett, who succeeded him as president of the company, but died very prematurely at about age 51 or 2, and really didn't have the opportunity to do what perhaps he would like to have done with the company. I knew a number of others in that next generation. Robert H. Mueller, who was the oldest grandchild, had worked in the company from the time he was about 16 years old. Of course, I knew quite well Frank Mueller, who produced the book that I was talking about a while ago. His older brother, Duke, who was a fine engineer and particularly time and motion study man. He wrote the book on standards, which was used for years throughout the company. That third generation, the grandsons of Hieronymus Mueller, were all active in the company. Grandsons were. There are none of them left now. Frank was the last one. He died about a year and a half ago. None of the fourth generation, and there are quite a number of them, have ever gone into the company. I believe some of them now serve as directors, but they have never been in the active management. While we're on the subject of the management of the company and the people involved, I suppose it's a rather natural question to ask, if Mr. Adolph were so dominant, where were the others and what were they doing? The answer is that there was a rather well-defined division of labor, if that's a proper term for executives, within the family and within the company. Henry Mueller, of course, died quite early, and this left then the five remaining sons. The next oldest was Philip Mueller, who's had inherited his father's mechanical ability, and he did all of the inventive kind of work. All the patents that the company obtained, he obtained the greatest number. He was the engineer, the inventor. The next brother was named Fred. He headed up the sales department. And it's been said that there wasn't a greater salesman that ever lived than Fred Mueller. The next brother was Robert, who I've already spoken of, who tended to the public relations of the company. Then Mr. Adolph, who as president and chairman pretty much ran the whole show. And finally, the last brother and the youngest child was named Oscar. He did not remain in Decatur during World War I. The company knew that Canada was in the war long before this country was, and Mr. Oscar went to Canada, opened up a Canadian plant which was making munitions for the Canadian government, and shortly afterwards he established another plant across the river. The Canadian plant was at a town named Sarnia. Across the St. Clair River is Port Huron, Michigan, and he established another plant in Port Huron, and he liked it so well up there that about 1925 or 6, he traded all of his stock in the company in return for a conveyance to him of all of the assets of the Port Huron plant, which he then ran as the Mueller Brass Company. It's gone through several changes of ownership, but he had left here quite early. But the four remaining brothers who were here, each one tended to his own area of expertise. Philip in the mechanical end, Fred in the sales end, Robert in the public relations and corporate structure end, and Adolph rather presiding over the whole show, but more particularly on the financial and management end of the business. So I'm sure that from time to time there was probably some friction among and between them. Couldn't help but be among strong personalities, but the company was fortunate in having four men, each of whom possessed the necessary expertise in the various departments of the company. No one of them, of course, was able to encompass all of the functions. So by natural selection, if you will, each one tended to his own department, and they all got together rather well. I remember it being said one time, though, that Adolf was walking through the plant and he ran on to Philip, the engineer, and said to him, Phil, we're going to have a company meeting this afternoon. Whereupon Phil turned around. Mr. Adolf's nickname in the family was Ott. He glared at him and he said, Ott, you know this is my afternoon to go fishing. I won't be there. So no one really bullied the other, but they all got along fine and made a company that has now been in Decatur for 125 years and is still owned entirely by the family. And although none of the Muellers are now active in the management, they comprise the board of directors, and said a moment ago, all of the stock of the company is owned by the descendants of Hieronymus Mueller.
Thank you very much, Judge Weber, for telling us this thrilling story of the Mueller Company and all that the Mueller family has meant to the city of Decatur. You have been listening to the history of the Mueller Company of Decatur as related by Judge A.G. Weber III, and this is Betty Turnell for the Decatur Public Library.